We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Welcome to a Wednesday afternoon edition of the RotoWire NBA podcast. Nick Whalen back with Alex Barusa. It's April 27th. We are brought to you, as always, by WynnBET. Make sure you're checking out WynnBET.com for all of your sports wagering needs. Plenty of NBA playoff action still to bet on. We got the NBA, or not the NBA draft, the NFL draft kicking off in Las Vegas on Thursday night. One of the best nights of the entire sports calendar. We got three NBA games for some reason, Alex. Scheduled for Thursday night. And had the Atlanta Hawks been able to pull the upset against the Miami Heat last night, they too would also be playing on Thursday night. So I feel like we've been having like minor complaints about the NBA schedule all season long. Why they potentially had four first-round NBA playoff games the night of the NFL draft is beyond me. But looking forward to previewing those games. I want to start with a little bit of a recap from last night. Off-air, we unanimously agreed to not really talk about the Hawks-Heat series, which was just kind of a slow bleed out for Atlanta, kind of a bizarre series for Trae Young. Almost felt like Miami was like resting starters by the end of it. They kind of knew where things were headed. But we had two more consequential games in the later window last night, Minnesota, Memphis, and New Orleans, Phoenix. I want to start with Minnesota and Memphis. Really fun game, essentially controlled by Minnesota throughout. You know, they led at the end of the first, they led at the end of the second, they went on a run and extended that lead to double digits heading into the fourth. And as we've seen from Minnesota multiple times in these playoffs, they blew 20-point leads in one single game in this series. They were in control. You know, Karl Anthony Towns hit that three to silence the crowd with, I think, about 2 minutes left in the game. It looked like Minnesota was in control. And yet again, couldn't get buckets late. And Memphis was the team that, after Minnesota had a fantastic ATO to tie this game up on an Anthony Edwards three, we saw an even better ATO from Taylor Jenkins to get John Morant free for what was essentially like a 2-on-1 and a close to buzzer beating layup.
Yeah. I mean, from the very end of this game, some things that stand out to me, D'Angelo Russell takes a terrible jump shot awful jump shot. And the first thing I'm thinking after he takes that jump shot is, do the Timberwolves have a timeout? Because I know how much Chris Finch hates taking timeouts. Mm-hmm. And it turns out they did. They did have a timeout available for that, like, what could have been, I guess, sort of like, they got bailed out by Anthony Edwards making that three. Because that D'Angelo Russell, like, 14-foot jumper was so stupid. Terrible decision. Finch should have called a timeout. I understand that he's like, oh, I don't want their defense to get set. But I don't know, man. I think you got to take a timeout there. And then on that play that John Morant gets free on the inbounds pass for a layup to win the game, Anthony Edwards makes like a horrible gamble and tries to go for this like wraparound steal, giving John Morant a huge runway to the basket. So that was awful as well. Like, why not just play that conservatively? Just really like two, you know, two really bad decisions, one by a coach and a player, another one just by a player for Minnesota to kind of lose this game.
Yeah, I had a lot of the same in my notes from the fourth quarter. You know, like on the Edwards three, initially I thought, like, how do you lose it? You know, it looked like it was maybe Brandon Clark's fault, and Ja Morant certainly thought so. He was kind of barking at Brandon Clark heading back to the timeout, but that was just a really, really nice play, you know, kind of a series of screens on the wing. And I thought Brandon Clark played it about as well as he could, because he had to show, you know, I thought if anything, Morant was maybe at fault a little bit for kind of it looked like he switched on the fly. It was unclear if they had communicated that beforehand, but I thought it was still a pretty good job by Clark. You know, he's a half step late, but, you know, to recover and still challenge that shot. Like, it, I mean, part of it was Anthony Edwards just being a crazy good athlete. He has a really high kind of over the head release that you're not going to block. But I thought it was a pretty good recovery and a pretty tough shot in the end by Edwards. And then, yeah, like you said, the one thing I love about Anthony Edwards is he's not going to mince words in the press conference. He was like, yeah, I went for the steal. Probably shouldn't have. On to the next one. You know, and he's like, it was a really bad decision. He was trailing Morant. But I think a lot of credit too goes to Dylan Brooks for the placement of that pass, because I don't know if that was the idea necessarily, or if he saw that Anthony Edwards was kind of overplaying Ja Morant to, I guess, like the backcourt side, and he put it in there perfectly, almost like leading a receiver and just kind of let Morant catch it on the go. I did think it was funny though that like the Grizzlies threw how many just like ridiculous, reckless alley-oops, especially late in that game. Like Morant had a pretty wide open alley-oop to, I think it was Bane. I could be wrong on that. On the other side, it, you know, kind of created that 2-on-1, and he decided to keep it. And because he's a super athlete with gadget arms, you know, was able to kind of lay it around the defender with the left. But I almost thought of all the ones to pass up on, the alley-oop there might have actually been the easier play.
Yeah, it may have been. I just figure at that point, he's probably like scared to continue, like try to make that pass. Like if you try to make that pass and it gets intercepted or tipped or the guy misses the oop, I feel like that's right. That's going to be worse than like you trying to make this like semi-contested layup.
Right. I mean, still a hell of a close by Morant. I think he had the final 13 for Memphis after Patrick Beverley, I guess, posted him up and gave him the, you know, too small sign. And then Patrick Beverley like immediately followed out after that. We saw Towns shushing the crowd after his three with, like, I think it was 146 remaining. It was a very Timberwolves loss, especially with how the rest of the series has gone. 22 turnovers. They had a possession late in this game where they inbounded to Towns. And they never showed the replay because I thought it almost was a kick. Like, it was just such a crazy turnover. And it ended up leading to a fast break for Memphis. Did this feel to you like Memphis stormed back at home and stole this game? Or did it feel like Minnesota should have won and just could not execute when it needed to?
I do think that Ja Morant dunk, was that to close the third quarter? It kind of brought the crowd back to life. It was like really quiet in there. You could feel like the tone. Things were pretty bad in there. And then Morant had this insane dunk. And then I think that kind of brought them to life, the crowd and the team. So I think that in a way helped swing the momentum for the Grizzlies. But I think the Grizzlies choked this one with those final plays. The Russell terrible jumper with Chris with Finch not calling a timeout, and then the Edwards gamble. And I thought, you know, Anthony Edwards had a good game. It was fine. He was kind of invisible for long stretches. I know he was in foul trouble, but he was taking some like pretty ill-advised threes late in the game that, you know, the Timberwolves had been having no issues all game getting the ball in the paint. Like, that seemed like to be their game plan. Like, get the ball in the paint. Get the ball with both your feet in the paint and then figure something out from there. And then towards the end of the game, all of a sudden, Anthony Edwards comes back in from having these five fouls and just starts chucking up three-pointers. And I felt like that kind of went against what was making Minnesota successful during the middle portion of the game.
Yeah, and they had multiple opportunities, I thought, to close this out. Edwards was not great other than that corner three down the stretch. I thought Tyus Jones had some really shaky plays by Memphis. Like Brandon Clark, his energy, you know, just basically going in, like not even trying to get rebounds, just going in, flinging his arm, trying to tip it out. That bailed Memphis out a couple of times. I think that's what led to the big Morant three late in the fourth quarter. He was fantastic. But yet again, we had another game that was completely marred by foul trouble. And some of the calls were, you know, were reasonable. Other of them, I think, you know, in a series like this, like you almost would like for the refs to kind of see how things are going and back off a little bit, because you got, I mean, Beverly fouled out, Jaren Jackson fouled out in 18 minutes, which is preposterous. Towns was in foul trouble. Edwards was in foul trouble. I don't know, this whole series, and I tweeted this, it just felt like one long play-in game. Like I wouldn't say I've like lost respect for Memphis, but look, there's a reason that the Golden State Warriors are now installed as, you know, the heavy favorites to win the title. They're 3-1 right now, and they were actually plus 260 yesterday. So that number has come down a little bit. Part of that, of course, is the Booker injury in Phoenix. But part of it is, I don't think we look at, you know, this Memphis Golden State showdown the same way that we would have coming into the playoffs, right? Where to me, that was kind of a 50-50 series. You know, I think I thought Memphis would beat Minnesota in five games. And with, you know, you have to remember at the time, we didn't know what Stephen Curry was going to look like. You know, Curry, Draymond, Clay had barely played together. So like the Warriors have looked fantastic. And I think Memphis is probably going to win the series. But I mean, what do you think the series money line ends up being for a Warriors Grizzlies conference semifinals? I mean, is that Warriors like minus 300, minus 350 at this point?
It might be. Yeah. And as far as like the sloppiness of the series, I feel like it's a bad sign that both these teams are, they seem like very nervous or yes. like weirdly excited to like play. And they just keep it's a lot of guys just flinging their bodies at the basket on both ends of the floor and just like hoping for the best. So I don't think it's a great sign that the Grizzlies are kind of just like not, they're not able to close this out with confidence. And they've gotten bailed out. It feels like more than they've like persevered, but yeah, I agree with you. I mean, in terms of like handicapping the next series, I just can't imagine the Grizzlies winning that series. I don't know what would have to happen to them internally for them to compete against what we're watching from the Warriors, which is just like a total evisceration of the Nuggets.
Does it feel to you watching this series at all that they've lost that kind of crazy, almost reckless level of confidence that it seemed like they built during the regular season, and especially during that period when Morant was out and it was kind of a take all challengers, we're just going to beat you? Like it feels like to me that kind of evaporated when they lost game one, and they've been kind of fighting to get that back.
I think so. And I think some of this is also, I mean, I've talked about this on, I think both of us have talked about this in the podcast before, and I've brought it up in different contexts of like, I think early in the year, trying to project how good the Grizzlies would be. It's like, you know, outside of Morant, who, I mean, how good are these guys really? Like, I know Bane has played really well. Like, we all love Desmond Bane. But, like, how good is this team actually? You know, like, if Desmond Bane is your second best player, and Morant is an emerging superstar, but is not like Jason Tatum. You know what I mean? Like, you and I had the conversation, like, a few months ago, would you rather have Tatum or Morant going forward? And I think both of us just still settled on, like, Tatum.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think this is almost making me think about that take again, where it's like, well, if Desmond Bane's your second best player, Jaren Jackson's supposed to be your third best player, but he can't play more than 25 minutes without fouling out. And then you're down to like Dylan Brooks as your number three guy already. Like, what really is that team?
It's still a good team. It's just not, you know, and part of it is the West is just weirdly down this year. You know, like two of the teams that normally I think most people would say would be competing for the title, the LA teams, you know, both those teams were big time busts for two very different reasons. So I think it's like part of this is like Memphis, not that they don't deserve to be the two seed. Obviously they won those games. They're better than any team in the East. I get all that. But I just think a team of this caliber that's this unproven typically doesn't finish second in the conference. You know, like I think if they were the four seed or the five seed, we would be like, yeah, they're playing as we expected. But I think because you see that little two next to the team, you kind of automatically assume a little more of that team. And, you know, this team is the two seed, earned the right to be the two seed, but is not your typical, you know, they don't have the strength, I think, of a typical two seed. And when you're watching this game in the fourth quarter, it's like, all right, you're closing with, you know, like Brandon Clark played 37 minutes in this game and Morant and Bane played 45 minutes. You know, like I like Dylan Brooks. He was 3 of 18. He was terrible in this game. Didn't give them anything. And, you know, their starting center all year is picking up DMPs. Yeah. You know, Xavier Tillman is starting at center, who's like an okay second rounder. And like you said, you're the guy who I think coming into this year, most people would have said was for sure your second best player, is currently averaging 21 minutes per game in the series because he's picking up 5 fouls in 4 minutes every single game.
Right. Yeah, there's just, I think, some things kind of fundamentally falling apart here for the Grizzlies. And like, I mean, I still think they're going to win the series, But it is kind of hard to imagine them, I mean, losing in the first round, which is still possible. Like, if they could, the way that I think Minnesota's kind of handed them these two wins, I mean, this series could basically be over by now, right? It's concerning. It's just hard to imagine. I think Grizzlies are both top five in offense and defense. Like, it's hard to imagine a team like that losing in the first round, even if it's a bad matchup, quote unquote. Just shocking.
Yeah, that's the thing. Minnesota's talented. And if you want to, you know, if you really are like a diehard Grizzlies fan and you want to say like, this is just a weird matchup for us, whatever it is about the Timberwolves, they play us well, you know, we'll throw that one out. Okay, well, the Warriors are who you're playing next. So you think that's going to be a better matchup? You know, like if you had Utah or Dallas in round two and you want to say like, I think we just match up better against those teams. Sure, I'm willing to have that conversation. But if you're struggling and the Minnesota Timberwolves are taking you to six or seven games, it's not going to get any easier against this Golden State team.
No, and it's, you know, Ja's having a bad series. Ja's passing fine, but 22 points. I mean, Desmond Bane's leading the team in scoring. So, you know, I just, that's a bad sign. I think the Warriors are going to make them look pretty bad. Assuming the Grizzlies even make it past this first round again, which I think they will, but.
If you're a basketball junkie, then you know there's no better time of year than the NBA playoffs. Twice a week, JJ Redick is cooking on his podcast, The Old Man and the Three. He has guys come on in all stages of their careers to talk about the league and share stories you won't hear anywhere else, including Devin Booker on why he talks so much trash, Ray Allen's epic free throw competitions with LeBron in Miami, and the moment Tyrese Halliburton knew Pascal Siakam would be a good fit in Indy. In addition to player interviews, every Monday, JJ breaks down the top three things happening around the NBA with unmatched analysis, not outlandish takes, and is often joined by masterminds of the game like Tim Legler to dive deep on rookie reports, trade breakdowns, and why is mean mugging now a tech? You won't find another outlet that covers the game as comprehensively and with such insight as JJ does it on The Old Man and the Three. Make this your companion podcast during the playoffs. Listen to The Old Man and the Three ad-free on Wondery Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences, so the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/BlueWire. Just go to Indeed.com/BlueWire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Whether you're a world-class athlete or a podcaster like me, we all understand the importance of mental and physical well-being and proper recovery for top-notch performance. That's why I'm excited that Unified Healing is sponsoring podcasts on the Blue Wire Network. Unified Healing is a new and super innovative global network of wellness centers powered by Energy Enhancement System, or EE System. If you haven't heard of the EE System yet, then you'll want to listen up. This technology promotes wellness, deep relaxation, purification, and rejuvenation. Wherever you are across the globe, access to a center is easy and affordable. Interested in experiencing the EE System technology for yourself? Go to unifiedhealing.com/bluewire to learn more and find a center near you. That's Unified, UNIFYD, healing.com/bluewire. No material or testimonials on the Unified Healing website are intended to be viewed as medical advice or a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified healthcare provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition or treatment and before undertaking a new healthcare regimen, including EE System.
All right, well, let's move on to the late game, New Orleans-Phoenix. Last night, I had high hopes that New Orleans could pull this upset just for fun. I don't root against Phoenix. In fact, I think it's actually probably better for the playoffs that Phoenix wins the series, gets Devin Booker back, and things kind of pick up where we left off in round two. But much better effort from the Suns in this game. Came out strong, you know, pushing the ball up and down the court. Mikal Bridges had easily his best game of the series. Still didn't shoot the ball all that well as a team. I mean, they were 10 of 27 from three, but we're helped greatly by New Orleans going 5 of 25 from beyond the arc, turning it over 15 times. Brandon Ingram was okay in this one. He had 5 of those turnovers. CJ McCollum really struggled, 7 of 22, 1 of 8 from three. I mean, simply put, without Devin Booker, even without Devin Booker on the other side, like, if McCollum and Ingram are combining to go 14 of 41 from the field, like, the Pelicans aren't winning any games.
No, I thought Ingram did. And I mean, he's been making really tough shots all series.
Yeah.
You know, so, and McCollum was firing pretty early in the shot clock sometimes. I thought he was taking some like nonsense shots without really running the offense. I guess the argument for that is, who else on this team besides him or Brandon Ingram is really going to do anything with the basketball that isn't like a cut or a defensive breakdown by the Suns or anything like that? Valanciunas continues to be good in the offensive glass, you know, puts in layups and stuff like that. Will occasionally hit a jumper. But the main takeaway from this game, I guess, is it felt pretty competitive throughout a lot of it. I mean, the Pelicans were still making it a game kind of in the fourth quarter. And considering how bad they shot, the fact that it was a game, while they shot so poorly and the Suns only committed 9 turnovers, you have to feel good going back to New Orleans. How do you feel about the Alvarado on Chris Paul strategy? Because I felt like he didn't actually play enough. Like, whenever Alvarado was not out there, I'm like, they got to get this guy back in the game. Like, I don't care who, like, I'll get, you got sit Jackson Hayes, Nance, whoever. Because he was, you know, I'm not saying he's not shutting down Chris Paul, but he's making Chris Paul work a lot. And he was getting tons of steals, making hustle plays. He was awesome.
Yeah, he was even better, I think you could argue, in that last game in New Orleans in game 4. I don't have a problem with it. I mean, I think you kind of need something. You need some sort of agitation, you know, to win a series like this when you're a massive underdog like New Orleans. I think I would play him more, I guess. I would not play Devontae Graham at all if I was the Pelicans.
He Najee Marshall? Minutes.
Yeah, well, Najee Marshall at least gave him something. I mean, Devontae Graham, man, I've come to the conclusion that, like, he is in the Kevin Porter zone of, like, you can't win with these guys. Like, he's like one of the most damaging players in the league. And credit to him. He's, you know, he basically got kicked out of the starting lineup when they got McCollum. His minutes have been slashed and he's still, like, you know, up on the bench cheering like crazy the whole game. But, like, I don't even know if you can get away with 12 minutes of Devontae Graham. They were -7 in his 12 minutes last night. You know, Alvarado, I think it's a little more of like peskiness with him. You know, it's not like he's quote unquote shutting down Chris Paul. It's like, he's 6'170". He can only really do so much. But like you said, he makes Chris Paul, in the back of Chris Paul's mind, when he's receiving the mindless inbounds pass after a make, like, you have to have your head on a swivel. Like, where is this guy? And you could tell it bothered Chris Paul in games 3 and 4 in New Orleans. And, you know, it led to him committing a hard foul. He got a flagrant. And Chris Paul kind of has a history of things like that. But, you know, you would think somebody of Chris Paul's stature in the league would kind of be able to block out somebody like Alvarado, and he wasn't able to. So, yeah, I think if you're Willie Green and you're the Pelicans, it's kind of like a lame thing to do. It's like, you never want to have to resort to like a gimmicky type of thing like that, but you don't really have a lot of other options.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to get like too deep in the weeds with this, but how often does Chris Paul have to deal with a guy that's shorter than him? That's like really pesky. You know what I mean? Like, whenever you envision Chris Paul kind of dominating a possession, at least like that results in a bucket, it's him just like crossing over some huge guy or some guy who's like 6'7" or 6'8" that like cannot keep up with his quickness. There's not a lot of guys in the NBA who are shorter than Chris Paul and are also good enough on defense to be like in a competitive basketball game. And so I think he's just not used to it. You know, so I think that's, yeah. I mean, if I was the Pelicans, I would just, you know, give those 12 Devontae Graham minutes to Alvarado and have Alvarado play 32 minutes. And I understand if like, he's so, I mean, maybe it's the case that Alvarado's those 20 minutes, like he's so gassed after that, because he really is like all over the place. Like, just, yeah. No, he's trying 100%. So if he can't play more than 20, 25 minutes, I get that. But I think you got to at least try.
All right. So let's do a quick reset on a couple other series. We got Bulls and Bucks game five tonight. We got Denver Golden State game five tonight. I mean, is there anything of real intrigue with either of these, or are these going to be just kind of put us out of our misery games?
I think they're pretty much going to be put us out of our misery games. Chicago's offense was already falling apart, and now is going to be missing LaVine and Caruso. You know, I guess it's possible they have some sort of a weird bounce back, and the Bucks kind of regress after two great games without Middleton. That's on the table. As far as the Warriors go, I really expect the Warriors to close this out tonight. I know they might start their new quote unquote death lineup. Kind of remains to be seen. I think they're just going to close it out at Golden State. I'm kind of interested at least to see like what Jokic has to offer in this elimination scenario. Like, is he just going to, because he's combined for, I think he's 37 points in each of the past two, or 35 and 37 in each of the past two games. I kind of wonder if he's going to be like going out with just like, I just got to take all these shots, you know? Like, is this just going to be a game we see from him where he's like, I cannot trust these guys in my team. I'm going to continue taking, like, I'm going to take like 30 shots this game and just go out that way.
Yeah, I mean, we've seen that from other superstars, right? I mean, Jokic has kind of seemed resistant to playing that style of basketball. You know, the last couple of years, they've been content to go down swinging. But I don't know. He had a couple of games, like against Portland in the playoffs last year. He took 31 shots in, I think that was game six or game seven. But you know, I mean, he's certainly capable of doing it if he wants to. It's just a matter of like, if you're the Nuggets, I think you see the writing on the wall at this point. I do think it's funny. You brought up the Steve Kerr, and I saw you quote tweeted this. The language on that was hilarious. Like, you know, they're still thinking about it, and he will decide before the game who he's going to start. So thank you for that one, champs. But like, has there ever been another team that is like, all right, this is clearly our best lineup. I don't know if we should use it. Like, Golden State has been doing this for like years now. Like, they wouldn't start the death lineup. They would save it for these little spurts. Like, what other team has a clearly best lineup that it is like so scared to use? Like, the way that they talk about it is like Steve Kerr, like, doesn't want to, you know, mess anything up. It's like, this lineup is too powerful.
Well, the Lakers were kind of doing that with Anthony Davis at power forward, right?
I guess, but that was more like they were just trying to like appease Anthony Davis because he didn't want to play center.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Cause that's different than what this Golden State situation is, yeah. Which is just like, we want Kevin Looney to rack up like four fouls on, you know, Jokic before we actually start playing, which is a very bizarre, like, who cares? Like, what?
Yeah.
I don't know, man. I can't think of another team that does that or would do that.
I do love the idea though. And I mean, I think Poole has kind of graduated to the point where you feel really comfortable with him in that role. I mean, there's potentially a case to be made that this would be, I would say, even more dangerous than the original, like pre-Kevin Durant death lineup. I don't think we're ever going to reach the Durant level, but I mean, at this point, like there's an argument to be made that Poole is as good, if not better, than Klay Thompson, right? Or at least this current version of Klay Thompson.
Yeah, I mean, well, they're different in the sense that like you don't really want to ever ISO Klay Thompson.
No.
So it depends on what you need, right? Like if you quote unquote need a bucket, Jordan Poole probably a better option than Klay Thompson. But I'm not going to trust Jordan Poole over Klay Thompson to like catch an open to catch a pass off a screen and just pull up from three.
Yeah. All right, let's talk Philly Toronto. I have nothing to say about Milwaukee. You know, we'll cross that bridge in a few days. You know, once that series is over and we hopefully get some sort of news on when Chris Middleton might make his way back. But obviously things. Kind of breaking Boston's way with that potential matchup and Middleton unlikely to be available for round two. But we need to talk about Philly-Toronto tomorrow night, which unfortunately is going up against the NBA draft. This game is inexplicably the NBA TV game tomorrow. Phoenix, New Orleans is getting the TNT slot, and then Dallas and Utah gets the late game. But I would say this is, so far, probably the most anticipated game of the playoffs for me.
Yeah, this is getting a little alarming in terms of the 76ers not being able to close this series out with like Barnes was out. Van Vliet's probably not going to play again. Like if you can't get this done, like what, like how is this happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's happening in the same way that I think everybody kind of joked that it could happen, right? Where it's like, if ever there was going to be a coach who could blow a 3-0 lead to an inferior team, it would be Doc Rivers. If ever there was a player who could lead that charge, it would be James Harden. And we needed some sort of catalyst because Philly looked really good early in the series, even with Harden not giving them a ton. They were dominating, and Toronto's falling apart. You got guys who are sick. You got, you know, Scotty Barnes is injured. Fred VanVleet's probably not even going to play in this next game. And it looked like everything was moving in Philly's direction. And then the Embiid injury happens. And, you know, I think if they do find a way to blow this, I mean, I'm not saying the jokes aren't going to fly because they are, but it is like a fairly legitimate excuse. It's like, hey, our best player tore a tendon in his shooting hand. Like, this is, it's a pretty big deal. But Embiid is playing through it. He's played almost 80 minutes the last two games. He's probably going to play 40 minutes again tomorrow night. So as long as he's out there, there's not going to be any excuses. And man, I mean, the series is not over, obviously, if they lose tomorrow night. But is there, like, outside of Philly, is there anyone who's going to be rooting for the Sixers? I don't think so.
No, I don't think so. Other than the people who, you know, kind of want to root for Joel Embiid, I think. But yeah, man, I mean, at this point, it's, the series is pretty close to even in terms of, like, yes, Philly is shooting the ball better and they're getting more free throws, but the offensive rebounding is pretty even, which is kind of alarming. Like, the fact that Toronto is pacing you in offensive rebounding when you have, like, all this size and they have none, that's bad. And, you know, Toronto just doesn't commit any turnovers, which is good. But there's no reason that, like, I think you can make the argument that Pascal Siakam's been the best player in this series. And for no, that should never even have been a discussion, whether or not Pascal Siakam, because you have Harden. I mean, obviously Embiid would be the favorite there, but even Maxi or Harden, even though people are down on Harden, it's, you know, and you're getting, I mean, you're still getting, like, some great performance. Like, Maxi's still playing out of his mind. You know, Tobias Harris is shooting 46% from three. And you figure if those two things were going to happen, that there's no way this series would even be close. Mm-hmm. So that kind of just speaks to some of Embiid's struggles from the field and from three. I mean, he's not really doing anything from three. And then Harden, you know, Harden also shooting 37% from the field. It's just awful. Although he's not turning the ball over. I think we have to give Harden credit at least for, you know, 46 assists, 18 turnovers. That's pretty good.
Small victories at this point.
Yeah.
I don't know how this is going to go. I mean, I certainly don't trust Philly, but they should still win. I mean, not having VanVleet is huge, although it didn't seem to matter whatsoever in game five. Like, it's not like it's not like the Raptors hit 25 threes and just, you know, had the super lucky win. Like, they dominated that game from start to finish. Like, that crowd was silent the entire second half. The line is only Philly -1.5 tomorrow night. I was telling James, like, if Philly finds a way to lose at Toronto on Thursday and we go back to Philly for a game seven, like, it would be super funny if the sports books were just like, all right, we're setting the line at Raptors -12. Like, we're not falling for this.
Yeah. They got to get ahead of the curve here.
Yeah, exactly. I hope we get that game seven. Like, that has all time, like, top five NBA Twitter comedy type of potential.
Yeah. I would be glued to the TV for that. There's no way. I mean, that would, there's no way. I can't even, I'm genuinely worried for the actual infrastructure of Philadelphia if that game is a loss. There might have to be, like, an emergency, like a state of emergency put out preemptively for the projected end time of that game. But it would be exciting.
That would be Saturday night, I believe, if I'm reading the ESPN.com schedule correctly. So maybe mark safe. That one down. Yeah, seriously. All right, let's talk about some of the composite rankings that you and I have been working on for a while. We're looking ahead to 2022-23 fantasy basketball. So a fair amount of projecting being done here. You know, we're going to kind of incorporate some of the rookies where we think they could fall. But we had a lot of fun putting these together, and there's going to be a full article and rankings up on the site within the next couple of days. We're just working on some analysis portion. But we have the hard data in there, and this is by far the most time-consuming and kind of difficult part to compile. So I just want to jump around and talk about the guys who we are the most different on. And it should be noted, we used a kind of rankings generator. So you do player versus player, and you just select, you know, one of the two who you would draft first. And it does, do you know how many comparisons it was? Like hundreds, 800?
800, something like that.
Yeah. So you're doing 800 comparisons, and you know, it essentially puts it into some giant equation that says if you like this player better than this player, then that means this player is below this player. So it, you know, we're not like doing these by hand. So there's a few that, you know, we'll have to go in and manually adjust if it doesn't come out exactly how we want. But I think for the most part, you know, we've used this in the past and it's been a pretty good representation. And then we take the average of our two rankings to create the composite. Ideally, you know, we'd have some more sets of rankings, but I think this does a pretty good job of at least standardizing for some of the outliers. With that said, there are several players who we are, you know, 30 plus spots different on. So we both have that sheet in front of us, and I'll let you lead it off. You can, you know, nominate any number of players who you want to talk about.
Well, one guy we did talk about quickly before the podcast, or we mentioned, was Kristaps Porzingis, who I had 37 and you had 83. That averages out to 60, which I think 60 is around where people will draft him. But I think this is just this, like, he's someone that's really tough to gauge due to, like, obviously injuries. Like, injuries play a huge factor here. Like, if you are totally avoidant of injuries in general, you're just not going to draft Porzingis until, like, yes, he gets to 83. If you are shooting for pure upside, then yeah, you draft Porzingis around 37 because he finished 25th this year, although he only played 51 games. So that's like one guy who I think is sort of indicative of a lot of the differences on our list. And also the team context is different. Like, you have Bradley Beal coming back and everything like that. So he's someone that I feel like is worth pointing out.
I'll throw out Zion just because he's,
yeah,
because he's Zion and people want to talk about him. I had him at 53. You have him at 35. He's somebody that I would definitely take above 53. I, you know, that this is one of those kind of casualties of how the ranking system spits things out. You know, I should probably move him up a little bit. I think 35 is pretty indicative of where he's going to end up. However, I feel like he wasn't going that much higher than 35 last year, and his stock has definitely diminished. And you know, you and I were having this conversation around this time in 2021 to kind of try to remind people that, like, yes, Zion is awesome. I know he played in a ton of games last year, but I think, like, last season at least, he was probably a more impactful real life player than a fantasy player. Just because, you know, he's kind of a points rebounds guy. The assists started to come a little bit, but the defensive stats really didn't. The field goal percentage is great. He was like top three contributor if you just isolate field goal percentage. But, you know, free throw line, still a major issue. And given everything that's happened in the last year, it's kind of hard for me to believe that a lot of those statistical shortcomings won't still be there.
Yeah, he finished, so 2 years ago in 2020-21, he finished as the 50th ranked player per game. So I'm jumping the gun a little bit at 35, although I am assuming some improvement. I guess there could be a slow start. Again, it's really tough to gauge considering what we've, you know, what he's gone through during this offseason and how the team's changed, frankly, around him, because now they've added, I mean, Valanciunas is a relatively like high usage guy around the paint, which is obviously where Zion likes to operate. You have McCollum coming in, who's a high usage guy at, I guess, point guard for them now. So, you know, I don't know, like, is point Zion going to continue being a thing? Because right now, I mean, you mentioned his rebounding. It's solid at 7.2, but he's more of like a two category contributor. Like, he's a points and field goal percentage guy, and mostly a field goal percentage guy. So I think people will draft him as high as 35, where I have him ranked, but I think he is probably closer. I think the risk is probably more appropriate around like either your ranking of 53 or the composite ranking of 44, given what we saw from him last year, the risks, how the team has changed.
And you mentioned it with Porzingis. I definitely tend to be more cautious with those type of guys, you know, hence why I have Porzingis so much later. And I have Zion a little bit later. Like I'm okay with, I guess, like being a year behind on some of those guys, because I think, I mean, if you take Zion like 28th overall, if you did that this past year, like you probably did not have any chance of winning your league. You know, I mean, you had to kind of hit on everything else for that to be the case. So like I'll happily take players like that if they fall into my lap, but I usually tend not to be too aggressive. One note on Valanciunas, you and I have him one spot apart. I have met 59. You have met 58. I kind of tried to factor in the Zion return. You know, this would be considerably lower than he's finished the last few seasons, two of those coming in Memphis. And then, I mean, he was 24th in total value this season, thanks in part to only missing eight games. But, you know, I think this early in the year, I think maybe some people will kind of forget to factor that in, that it's going to be almost impossible for him to keep up that kind of production, especially as a rebounder, if he's playing next to Zion.
I think so too. Some of it's going to depend on, are they going to have him shoot more threes? You know, because he's been a really good three-point shooter for the past three seasons. Like, he is, past three seasons, he's hitting, again, he's only hitting half a three per game, but it's over three seasons, and he's 37%.
Yeah, so 41% this year.
Yeah, so I think there's a chance we see Valanciunas shoot more threes. But, yeah, I'd be a little worried about the rebounding, especially offensive rebounding, because Zion doesn't defensive rebound.
I'll go a couple guys that I was higher on than you were significantly. So Onyeka Okongwu, I have 84 spots higher than you do. So that's like almost like a full draft higher. That to me is just like projecting that, you know, they're going to find a way to play him more. It almost felt like they really wanted to this year, and then Capella came back and it never really came to fruition. But like that's me like taking some liberties and saying that they're going to find a way, whether that means moving Capella or, I mean, you can't really play them together, I guess, but probably just means moving Capella. I think they're going to find a way. I mean, he's going into his third year. I don't think you necessarily want him, you know, languishing in this like 15-minute-a-night role for a third straight season. So, you know, that's one that's going to jump out for sure. His composite rank came out to 142, which is probably about right. Obviously, I would take him higher. You'd maybe go a little lower. Let's see. I'm trying to pick out. So, like, a lot of the names that we were way off on are role players who are very subjective, you know, like the Dorian Finney-Smiths, Alex Caruso's, Isaiah Stewart's of the world. So I'm trying to find somebody who's a little,
and
has a little more name value.
And like team context obviously plays an important role here too. Like the Okongwu point's important because you have him 100th and I have him 184th. Like you mentioned, he finished 146 this year playing 20 minutes. And for me, it was like, well, I just don't know about Capella. Like if Capella gets moved, or there's some sort of internal commitment like preseason, they're like, well, we're going to actually start a Okongwu this year. Well, then, yeah, I'm going to draft him closer to 100. Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm sure if they came out, they're like, no, you know, Capella's fully healthy. He's going to play 35 minutes a game. It's like, well, you can't draft Okongwu 100. But I agree with you. It does seem like they're trending more towards wanting to take him.
Yeah, for sure. Let's talk about the second year guys. I had some trouble, you know, trying to place these guys because every year somebody, you know, some second year player ends up finishing like top 20, but I didn't want to put Scottie Barnes over a lot of big names. And one thing too, that kept striking me is we have so many players who were busts or were injured this year, like big name guys who ended up finishing like, you know, well outside of the top 40 in total value. And some of them in per game value, even that like bringing back Kawhi and Dame and Beal and Anthony Davis. I'm sure there's others that I'm missing. Like, there are so many of those guys who are like perennial top 15 to 20 guys that it kind of artificially pushes some guys back. And when you start to look at it, you know, you stack up the rankings, it's like, would I really take Scottie Barnes over Devin Booker? Would I really take him over Donovan Mitchell? The answer is probably no. So I ended up moving him down a little bit, but it looks like I'm about 10 spots higher on Scottie Barnes, who I have at, this is bringing me to Harrison Barnes for some reason.
38.
I have him at 38. And you have him at 50. Similar spread on Cunningham. I think I'm about 10 spots higher on him. Any like real pushback there? I have Cunningham at 32. You have him at 42. Or is that just you know, kind of leaning toward the more known commodity?
That's just leaning towards the more known commodity. I mean, Scottie Barnes finished 70th this season.
Yeah.
Not that he can't jump up to 38th. I mean, I think that's reasonable. I mean, given what we've seen from him and how important he's been in the playoffs for them, like I'm a Scottie Barnes believer. So some of this to me, like you mentioned, was just a casualty of like, well, I think Bradley Beal's going to have a better season. Well, I'm not really going to take Scottie Barnes over like Kawhi. You know, how do I feel about like Bam Adebayo or Gobert? You know, how good do I think Anthony Edwards is going to be? Barnes or Sabonis? Like those are just really tough questions. Come draft season, it could easily be like trend closer to like 40.
So for reference, in my own rankings, I had him in the same area as like Brandon Ingram, Ja Morant, DeMar DeRozan, Miles Bridges, Desmond Bane, Jared Allen, Evan Mobley, Chris Middleton. You know, so he's kind of outside of that truly elite range. I would take Sabonis over him every single time. Is there a chance that Barnes could explode and finish ahead of Sabonis? Yes, for sure. But I think like, you know, for sure, like if Sabonis plays 65 to 70 games, he's going to finish as a top 30 guy. Like, that's definitely not a guarantee with Barnes.
Right. Some of this is like floor versus ceiling. It's like, well, if I think Sabonis's floor is Scottie Barnes' ceiling, I'm just going to take Sabonis.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Let's talk about a few of the card guys. So James Wiseman at 119. I have him at 142. I mean, we haven't seen him play in forever. I have no idea really what to expect there. I mean, is 119 basically like, I'll take him with the last pick in a draft and hope it turns out okay?
Yeah, see, so yeah, a lot of my rankings were just like, if I'm choosing between, if I have the last pick of the draft, and it's like, well, you can have James Wiseman or Justin Holiday. It's like, listen, man, like, I'm just going to take Wiseman because, you know, most of the time, I wouldn't say most of the time, but a lot of times in drafts, if you're just like a standard 12-teamer, the last like four or five guys you pick, those guys are all, you swap them in and out of the waiver wire. They're on your bench all year. You're streaming them. So you may as well just go for upside. And at that point, it's like Wiseman's pedigree to me is enough. You know, he's going to get Looney's minutes, I think, at the very least, no matter how much Steve Kerr loves Looney. Yeah, I think they have some sort of organizational commitment to him, even though it may not seem like it. Plus, he could get traded. Again, you never know. So we're projecting a lot of stuff here.
So Ben Simmons, I had at 82. You have him at 57. Another somewhat similar situation of a guy that we just haven't seen in forever. To me, 57, like looking at my personal rankings, that would be the same. And these are different from yours. So, you know, no judgment. But like in that same range are like Jamal Murray, Terry Rozier, John Collins, CJ McCollum, Julius Randle, Valanciunas, Maxi, Hero. Like to me, I would take those guys are good enough and they're known enough as commodities that I would take them over the unknown that is Simmons. You know, like even to be like, even if Ben Simmons like figures everything out mentally, his back is fine. I just don't know what kind of upside we're looking at for a guy that hasn't played in that long. Like this kind of goes back to what we talked about with the other injured players like Zion and Porzingis. At some point, like he's not on my do not draft list. Like if he's there at 85 and I'm picking between Ben Simmons and Bogdan Bogdanovich or Dylan Brooks, like, yeah, I'll probably take Ben Simmons there because there is enough upside. But to me, when you're talking about, you know, the fifth round, that's still a little too early for how much risk there is.
I think there is risk. Some of this will come down to like what the noise is coming into preseason.
Yeah. I mean, to be fair, his stock is at like an all time low right this moment as we're making these rankings.
Right. Exactly. So, I mean, the last season that he played, so 2 years ago, he was 66th per game, which was his lowest rank of his career, right? He averaged 14 points, 7 rebounds, 7 assists, and a steal and a half. To me, it's hard for me to even imagine Ben Simmons not averaging 14, 7, and 7. Even if the Nets are stacked, right, you put him in like we're assuming they're going to start him at center. You put him in this Draymond type role, which everyone keeps saying, but hey, maybe it's the case. I mean, he's going to get, you know, 6 to 8 points in transition. The passing, he's going to be making open passes to Durant and Kyrie. Maybe you have some concern about the free throw shooting. I mean, maybe he has some sort of mental block. He starts shooting like 40% from the free throw line. But, again, I feel like last season was almost, I don't know. It's still hard for me to imagine his statistical floor being like significantly lower than it was last year.
Yeah. I mean, and even if he is a diminished version of his peak self, you know, there is enough diversity there in what he offers that it could kind of end up being a Draymond like stat profile. And probably with better field goal percentage than Draymond offers. I think the ship has sailed at this point on any hope that he's going to become a 3-point shooter. Like, that's now like the fifth most worrisome thing about Ben Simmons is that he can't shoot threes. Like, that now seems like a distant problem. But that's going to be one of the more difficult ones. You know, I'm looking at some other players we're differing on. You were way higher on Kevin Porter than me. We are 61 spots apart on him. That is just me like not trusting him. He turned it over a ton. Fair. Field goal percentage was bad. I don't even know that he's, you know, for sure going to hang on to that starting role. Like, I know he's young enough to be a part of the Rockets core, but, you know, both him and Christian Wood, it's like, are these really the guys you want leading yourself into the next decade?
Yeah, that one was, he came out a little higher in my own rankings than I thought he would.
Yeah.
But at the same time, you know, over the past few years, I've kind of shifted to where it's like, once I get to that like sixth or seventh round, I'm just going to start taking shots on guys who I know are high usage that are relatively young. Even if I think Jalen Green's going to kind of take over for that team. Porter's still a high usage guy. He's still young. Finished 96 this year. So there's still room to grow there. And I don't know, man. I'm fine with taking him at, again, you know, if you're looking around that 70 to 80 range, it's like, would you rather have Kevin Porter or, like, you know, you're talking about, like, I don't know, you're bumping up against Tobias Harris, Josh Hart, Buddy Hield, maybe. And I feel like if you're shooting for pure upside, I think I'm still of the belief, and I think other people are too, that there is a chance Kevin Porter takes some sort of, like, not maybe a huge leap, but, like, if he averaged 18 and 8 next year compared to 16 and 6.
Is that 8 turnovers?
Maybe. Hey.
Eight times leaving the arena during the game?
Hey, we're playing 8 cat, all right? Turnovers don't count.
Yeah, if you're in a league where you get a bonus if your player, like, departs the arena mid-game, right, then he's probably the number one pick. All right, I know you got to get out of here. You got to do video. Real quick, I'll read the composite top 12. I think it looks pretty good to me, but tell me if you think there's one name that we either omitted or somebody should be higher or lower. So it came out in order: Jokic, Curry, Tatum, Giannis, Harden, Trae Young, Towns, Durant, Doncic, Embiid, LeBron, Damian Lillard.
I think, here's what I will say. I think the hardest person in this top 12 to gauge is James Harden. I have no idea. Like, we both had him sixth. I don't really know what to do with him. Like, part of me thinks that this year was some sort of weird fluke and he lost motivation and that he'll bounce back. The other part of me is like, well, he's still playing. He can't shoot the ball in the playoffs. Like, he's just not able to score against the Toronto Raptors. He just can't score efficiently. So I just have no idea what to do with him. Is he going to average 17 points a game next year? You know, maybe. Is it going to be on better efficiency? Who knows? I just have, like, no idea. I think his draft range, you know, I think come draft season, when we talk about ranges these guys go, I think some people are going to draft Harden fourth. Some people are going to be like, I'm going to get him 13th.
Yeah.
So it's going to, I think he's really tough to figure out.
Yeah, I think he's tough. I think LeBron is tough because In years past, like, the LeBron injury thing has become a narrative, but he also had some pretty big holes in his fantasy profile. He's now, like, the most dominant statistical player in the league, but he also might miss 20 games. And obviously, like, we're not even factoring in, you know, he'll be in his 20th season, which almost seems like a footnote at this point. Like, I remember talking with you, like, 5 years ago about, like, is this the year LeBron finally drops off? And here we are. Like, I don't think it's going to be next year. The one thing I will say is that none of the guys who kind of broke through this year, it's a group of four guards, you know, DeJounte Murray, LaMelo Ball, Darius Garland, Tyrese Haliburton. All those guys made huge leaps. A couple of them finished first round value. It does seem like we were still a little more biased towards the guys who've done it, you know, for 5 to 10 years, as opposed to these guys who were really awesome last year. But, you know, we kind of need to see them prove it again.
100%. Like, there is a very real chance that DeJounte Murray and LaMelo Ball finish over Damian Lillard. I think that could easily happen. Am I going to be the guy who banks on it happening? Probably not. But it's possible.
All right, man. I know you got to get out of here, so I'll let you go on that note. Appreciate all the work on the composite and looking forward to getting this up on the site.